Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Backpacking Experience Podcast. If you are new to the podcast, my name is Devin.
And I'm your host.
And thank you for being here and checking out the conversations that I have here on the podcast. There are 30 or so other episodes before this one with all sorts of topics discussed around backpacking. I've got hikers and owners and managers and such of various different companies in the outdoor industry. Just great conversations in those previous episodes. My guest today is Justin Hick from the YouTube channel Justin Outdoors. He and I take the next hour or so to talk about some of the basics with planning a backpacking trip. He's coming into the conversation with a lot of great information from years of outdoor experience, and we have a great time together on this one. Really enjoyed the conversation with Justin. But before we jump into that, I want to thank the sponsors of this episode. You're likely familiar with Sawyer already as the maker of hollow fiber water filters, but did you know that for much of Sawyer's history, they have been making insect repellents long before entering the market with water filtration options? The Picardin, and I know I'm saying that wrong, but the Picardin lotion is easily my favorite and one of the more effective insect repellents I've ever used. We all love to be out in the woods, but I haven't met anyone that enjoys having ticks on them or getting eaten alive by mosquitoes. So Sawyer's Picardin is incredibly effective at keeping insects off of you and bites to a minimum. It's also safe for outdoor fabrics and low odor. So I definitely recommend Sawyer when you're looking for a new insect repellent for your backpacking needs. I also want to thank longtime supporter of the podcast, Art of the Trek. We will talk more about Art of the Trek later in the episode. Thank you for listening to the episode today and hope you enjoy the discussion Justin and I have about backpacking trip planning. So very excited to have Justin on the podcast. We've been trying to get connected for a while to make this happen. So Justin, welcome. Glad you're here.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm glad we could make this happen as well. I know we're both pretty busy guys, but chatting with you and everything, it's been something that I've been really looking forward to.
Yeah, so we've got a great conversation planned that's a little bit different, and we've been having a little bit of conversation back and forth on what we want to talk about, and that's primarily trip planning for newer backpackers or even anybody out there listening that happens to be more experienced and have a lot of backpacking experience. Hopefully what we discuss and kind of banter back and forth with each other tonight is going to provide some additional education. That's kind of the goal of what we're trying to accomplish with this particular conversation that Justin and I have kind of formulated and put together. So rather than me interviewing Justin and talking about his awesome YouTube channel and his particular background, Justin and I are going to share our personal experiences of just how trip planning has become a really important part of what our outdoor experiences are built around. And I mean, I'm speaking for myself in that, but I know, Justin, you have a lot of outdoor experience, right?
Yeah, I've been an avid outdoorsman for 2.5 decades now with multi-day trips happening for the last 20 years or so. So it's definitely a bit of experience, and it's evolved quite a bit, especially on the trip planning front in the last 20 years.
Oh, that's awesome. And now you live in Canada, correct?
Yes. I'm up in Calgary, by the Canadian Rockies. So yeah, basically just north of you, cause you're down in Utah, correct?
Yeah. So sounds like if I take Interstate 15 straight north, I'll run into you, huh?
Yeah, I think so. I think I went down to past Utah once. It was about a 20-hour drive, so not too bad.
But you're in the Canadian Rockies. It sounds like you've got quite the backyard of playground for you to spend some time in, right?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably one of the more beautiful places that I've been in the world, and I feel pretty lucky to have the Rocky Mountains an hour drive out of town and can go out pretty quickly on a weekend. And I think that's something that sounds like for both of us is part of our trip planning that we maybe take for granted, is that we don't have those 6-hour drives to get to a trailhead.
Yeah, totally. So I'm interested to get a little bit more just background from you. A couple decades worth of outdoor experience. Is there a primary like form of backcountry travel that you enjoy? Is it mostly backpacking? Are you doing any kind of water sport like kayak touring, other types of things that have been in your repertoire of like outdoor experience, basically?
Yeah, I grew up out on the East Coast, actually. I grew up in Ontario outside of Ottawa. And
oh, okay.
Because of that, that area is a big river lake part of the world, I guess. So my outdoor experience started off with canoeing and kayaking and water-based travel. And I don't think I did a backpacking trip until I moved out west about 10 years ago. So it was all canoe tripping before that. Anything from a weekend up to my longest was a 30-day canoe trip. And as I came out west and started doing activities out here, took up backpacking and in wintertime, a lot more ski touring trips, snowshoeing trips, and moving through the backcountry in that way.
Yeah, the water aspect is something that I'm not as familiar with. I've done a little bit of kayak touring and some like 17-foot kayaks in Teton National Park, which was incredible. But aside from that, it's been very minimal. So maybe at some point I'll have to make a trip north and we could do some portaging.
Yeah, there's not as much around here.
Portage,
I think. I don't know. That's every once in a while I get French words mixed up with English words. But there's a few rivers up here that are pretty good for going on canoe trips. And then there's an area in BC, the Bowron Lakes, which is world class. Definitely a place to visit.
I'm excited to have you on here to discuss this because not only do you have the outdoor experience, but our different locations are going to help kind of bring that understanding of how we might plan trips differently based off of where we're going. Mm-hmm. And so I think the first question that I'll ask to kind of start how we would basically get the concept of, okay, I want to go on a backpacking trip. How do I even plan that? How do I make that happen? I've never done it before. How do I make it happen? So the question for you is, how did you start learning how to plan backpacking trips? Like, can you remember that far back?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. And I think when I first started out, I did not have a lot of the planning within my own hands. I was going with more experienced people and learning from them in a big way. It was always interesting being part of that process a little bit, or at least seeing its evolution. And when I look back now, I can appreciate some of the decision making that was going on at the time. Looking at things like weather, group size, the places that we're going, how much food we need, all those kind of, there's so many different decision making things that go into trip planning. But I think one of the big things from when I first started out was the trip leaders or the people organizing it were always looking at the skill level of the group. If there was a group.
Yeah. That makes sense.
And I think if you're starting out, I think that's probably a good place to start is look internally and see how much experience do you have in the backcountry. I think there's probably a big difference between someone who hikes every weekend compared to someone who may get out for a couple hikes a year or something like that, just with the familiarity with the backcountry and the conditions that you might encounter and all the different risks and factors involved.
Yeah. So I think that like you bring up some good questions, I think that is important for anybody that is planning any backpacking trip is what's my skill level or the skill level of the group that I'm going with, and whether it's a friend or it's a professional group, or you happen to be guiding a group of people. That's something that I do personally. Mm-hmm. I'm an instructor at a university. I take students out. They're college students. They're adults. They should be able to make adult decisions, but very often I'm taking students that have never even put a backpack on before. And like, yeah, those questions that come into your mind of, okay, I legitimately have to be more mindful of the location that I choose because of the skill level of the people that are going with me versus like, I mean, I don't say this to like toot our own horns or anything, but if you and I planned a trip together, it would be a very different type of trip.
Yeah,
I would imagine at least. It doesn't have to be that way, but I mean, those are the kinds of questions that I think it's important for anybody to ask. What's the skill level of yourself, of the group or the people that you're going with? And then other questions to ask that like, how long are we going to go? Is it a 2-day trip, an overnight, a weekend, or a week long? Or is this a through hike? Is this like several months long, like the Appalachian Trail, or I don't know any long distance trails in Canada, but
great divide trail. I'm going to be hiking it this summer. Trail. Yeah,
there you go. But yeah, so like, and knowing how long you're going out, and then what's the season? Because all of these questions, obviously, you're going to have an answer to them, and those answers are going to dictate other decision-making processes in your planning of that trip that help you select the right gear, that help you choose your, I mean, outside of gear, but there's also like the food that you need to take. And do I need a bigger pack? Do I need all these various variables that are important to consider? That if you don't ask those questions, then you might find yourself, no pun intended, up the creek.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's always interesting, especially you bring up a good point around some of the things like the length of time that you're going to be out there. Something that I always consider, because I'm usually going on shorter trips. I think we're both probably in the same boat, that we're more weekend warrior / mm-hmm. the occasional like longer trip. But yeah. Weather ends up being a bit of a factor that I'm paying attention to, just because it's going to influence some of the gear I'm bringing. Whereas if you're on a through hike, you're kind of just stuck with what you have. The weather, other than unless it's a very sketchy safe, like from a safety perspective, doesn't really matter if it's 10 degrees warmer or colder than the day before.
Yeah. So let's say now that, you've selected a location, and that location, let's use a national park here in Utah, for example. Let's pull my favorite national park, Capitol Reef.
Okay.
National Park. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but I'll give you kind of like some conditions, and you could tell me maybe some of the decision making processes that you would go through based off of this like limited information.
Okay.
So let's say we're going to Capitol Reef National Park. So that should give you some cues of things that you should consider. Second is it's a desert trip and it is March. So a little bit early in the season. Water is scarce. Typically only found in random springs that may or may not be running in March.
Okay.
As well as, you're in like canyon bottoms with high, tall, like canyon walls. So consider weather and like air temperature and stuff with that. And we're going to be gone for a weekend doing 15 miles.
Okay.
With that limited information and not being super familiar with the area, what kind of process are you going through to now plan like a basic itinerary for this trip?
Yeah, I think you'll probably have to help me out a little bit on this one with the desert factor. But I think sure. we talked a little bit about the group. I think because of the different complexities in the trip, as far as it being earlier season, limited water, so potential. I see the potential for water water carries. Then I'm probably not going to be inviting someone who hasn't backpacked before on this trip. So it's probably going to be more of a a trip. If I'm going with other people, a trip that I'm going to be taking experienced backpackers on. You mentioned it's a national park. So I think, I'm not sure if it's the same in the US, but every national park in Canada basically requires a permit for any campground or area that you're going into, whether that's a backcountry random camping permit or not. Is that the same in the States,
yeah,
basically,
yeah, for totally. National parks? Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, for the most part, there are some exclusions, but for the most part, you need a backcountry permit.
Okay. Yeah. I think the permit, I know the permit thing can sometimes be a bit of a hassle for some of the parks that you're going into. But a thing that popped out to me was water, because I find water can make or break a trip. If you start getting dehydrated, your body's going to start shutting down on you. So if there's limited water availability, then I'm making sure that I have enough carrying capacity, whether that's an extra water bladder, a couple extra water bottles, in order to carry water between when the spots are. But I'm not sure if like what the water sources are like, but I know you, with the different mapping software that I use for planning trips, a lot of the time you can see where there's rivers and creeks, and they'll also show springs up in Canada here. So you can kind of check out where the water sources are. Is that something that would you be able to get that data from mapping software for the springs?
Yeah. And so that's kind of a good tangent to talk about, because there's a lot of different resources that people can use to find out that kind of information. And it's not necessarily always about like water availability. Obviously, there's that, but like permit information and access to the trailheads and where to park and is there a cost for it? Just all those kinds of things. If you can't find information on a topo map, for example, often like there's probably a blog post that somebody's written about it that is going to have some information, or various forums that you can reach out that somebody has been on that trail in that time of year and is probably going to have some information. And then there's always the ability to call the ranger and to call the ranger station, ask them. And I do this all the time. I actually have, this is how nerdy I get with my trip planning, but I actually have the cell phone number for the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, the backcountry ranger. Nice. And so I'll call him on occasion and ask him like, hey man, what's the water situation like in this particular canyon? What's the water like in this? And have anybody been down there? And it's maybe not something that a new backpacker is going to think about, but those are the kinds of resources that make being able to plan a trip a lot easier. And water, I mean, water's life, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're going to the mountains and you know there's a mountain stream, like that's less of a concern for me than it is in the desert, because obviously the desert we know is a dry place, but yeah, just those kinds of tools, knowing how to use them, and they're available. But I'm curious go ahead.
I think you make a great point about the rangers, and I think this is something I recommend to people all the time. Like the fact that you have the ranger on speed dial is probably a good indication of how valuable of a resource it is. But I call the rangers up here as well to get information, and whether a bridge is in over a creek, so whether we need to do a creek crossing with a bridge or not, and even avalanche danger, they'll sometimes have some information on whether the melt in the springtime, whether the melt has been significant enough to eliminate the avalanche danger. They're just, whether it's through a call or email, I think people out there, if you're planning a trip and you're a little bit unsure, then calling the ranger, they're always, I've never encountered a ranger that wasn't happy to chat and provide some advice and thoughts.
Totally. And if they're not happy to do it, they're not doing their job correct.
Yeah, exactly. Ask them to put you onto somebody else. There's someone out there, whether it's a trail crew lead or something like that, that would be happy to provide some trail information for you.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with, with calling the ranger and saying, hey, I am not from the area. I'm looking to do a backpacking trip in this particular national park, or I've heard good things about this trail. Can you tell me about it? Or I saw it on Instagram, hopefully not geotagged, but we can talk about Leave No Trace a little bit later in the conversation, but just asking them for recommendations. And if you've done a little bit of homework yourself, that's going to help you in the conversation, because I think that in some cases, a ranger is probably going to point you to less, what am I trying to say? Things that are not as like difficult, because they don't want to be a liability for sending people out on crazy trips. But if you're asking good information, you've done some homework and you're just looking for very specific things, they will hear that you have done your homework and be more willing to share good information that is beneficial to being able to be successful in having a great experience out there.
Exactly. And like we said, kind of at the beginning, understanding your own experience and knowledge and limitations. If you're able to express that to the ranger and say, I've been backpacking for 5 years. I've been on a bunch of 5-day trips and I'm looking for something like 20 kilometers a day for 3 days kind of thing, with moderate elevation, then they'll be able to come back at you with probably some pretty, pretty good specific recommendations.
Yeah. So getting into a little bit more of the tools, we talked about like water access and availability, and you mentioned a little bit about like mapping software. What particular tools are you using to help you find trips? Because I think that somebody new to backpacking, they're not going to get on CalTopo or Gaia GPS or Topo Maps Plus and know how to plan a trip. Like, and even understanding how a topo map functions is not like common knowledge. You have to understand contour lines and the way that the contour lines work to be able to give you understanding of elevation change. And there's a lot of information, and even being able to understand what the distance and length between contour lines means for elevation change. And like, that's all really important stuff that if you're looking at a map, you should be able to understand it. But if you dial it back a little bit, are there any tools that you use? You're like, hey, I want to go to the northern Canadian Rockies. I've never been up there before, and I'd like to see if there's any backpacking loops or point A to point B out and back trips that I could do. Where are you looking for those kinds of things?
My first spot is, and this is from when I first came out to the Rockies and was looking for trips, to even now, if I'm going to a new area that I've never been before, my primary tool is Google. I'll just kind of type in like top 5 hikes or top 5 backpacking trips in Jasper National Park, and I'll usually come back with some pretty popular spots. And not choosing like the number one is a good way to try and avoid the crowds a little bit.
Sure.
But it's I find that a good way, especially if I don't want to have to do a lot of planning. Usually these trips are well established. There's amenities at each of the campgrounds. Usually like with any sort of results, you can then search for blog posts, or people will give you itineraries and just kind of build a trip off of that. You don't really even need to get into the nitty gritty of looking at maps. The itineraries usually have you covered as far as water access goes and all those different factors.
Yeah. And a lot of those blog posts are very detailed. Like, I've seen several different blogs that that the writer particularly went and did that trip, and they ran their Garmin inReach and tracked their whole route. So they've got a map that's shared, so you can see exact locations of that route. And there's some blogs that I've seen that they'll give you very specific GPS location of how to get to the trailhead and set your odometer to zero and drive this far and then turn left, like really specific things. But then there's also just like the more generic, like overview, like, hey, you should go do this, or this is the top five trips here in Southern Utah. Yeah. And that kind of stuff. And it's going to have a lot of good information. Like you said, water availability, permit information, are animals allowed, and whether or not you need to pack out your waste, like wag bags, like all of that can be found by just doing a simple Google search.
Yeah, exactly. That's always my first place to start. I think it's the easiest. And like you said, it's much more straightforward and simpler than trying to go on topo maps and design your own route. Even if there are some trails on there, it still doesn't take into account a lot of those other factors. So it's nice to follow in someone's footsteps when it's when you're, especially if you're first starting out with backpacking trips and planning your own trips.
Yeah. So how did you kind of transition? Well, I shouldn't say transition, because even I, with how nerdy I get with actually like mapping routes out on Google Earth and Topo, and then exporting them to my phone and everything. But how do you, in your trip planning, take the information that you find from forums and blog posts and Google searches and then translate that into usable information on a map that now that you're out in the backcountry, you're not going to have internet access. You're not going to have the ability, unless you screenshot a blog post, obviously, but like the more important tool is having a mapping software or app loaded up on your phone. How are you using that? And where did you like basically get the general education around understanding how to use map and map software?
Yeah, I think it's definitely started with canoe tripping and map it. Even though you're basically on a path, like a very well-defined path the entire time, there's a lot of mapping, especially if you are doing portages, that you need to be aware of. So that was my first exposure to mapping, and then like map and compass navigation. And luckily it's a kind of,
can I interrupt you here for a second?
Yeah.
What's the quick explanation of a portage for anybody that doesn't understand it?
Fair enough. So if you're canoeing along a lake and then you hit some land, sometimes will be either just like a wetland or some sort of uncanoeable barrier between that lake and then the next lake that you want to get to. So you'll have to carry your canoe and all your gear overland to get to the next water body. So that's
a portage.
That's a portage is the act of carrying everything over.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Continue.
So that was my first experience with mapping and compasses. And you kind of learn with those as well. If you're on a river where you might encounter some waterfalls or rapids, you start reading, when you see contour lines closer together, you start knowing, okay, that's going to be a steeper part of the trip. So I need to be a little bit more aware that there could be rapids there that I may or may not want to avoid. So that was the first exposure. And then once I moved out west, we started seeing different tools like Gaia GPS and CalTopo and FatMap more recently start to emerge with digital topo maps available. And I've been using those pretty much predominantly as far as my planning goes. It's so easy to zoom in and out on an online map and plan your trip and see what's happening. And then usually I use Gaia GPS. And then once I have a route planned, I've kind of drawn out my route on the map. I then export that to my phone, download the offline map. And then I'll even go a step further and export that map to my watch, because my watch has mapping features with topo on it and everything. And that kind of gives me the breadcrumb trail to follow with what features like contour lines and water features. And sometimes, depending on how complicated the trip is, I'll make some notes in my phone as well, or write some notes down and bring a piece of paper with like, okay, after 2 kilometers, you definitely have to make sure to fill up on water or take the left turn, because if you go right, it's really easy to go right based on the blog post that I read, but you'll die or something.
Yeah, that's great information. And the one that I'll add, just from my experience, is, and this is getting into basically the sponsor of this particular episode, but I've talked a lot about Art of the Trek. Have you used Art of the Trek on any of your trip planning?
I have actually. I never got to fully experience it, but I contacted them based on listening to your podcast. Actually, it inspired me to chat with them about a trip I was going to do down into Arizona, into the Phoenix area, and I was looking at different routes down there that I wanted to do for a 4-day trip, and they helped me plan out some different routes and looking at permits and water sources, like super detailed. And it was great, cause I didn't have to, I was super busy with work at the time, so I didn't have time to get into the nitty gritty of planning the trip, and they just did it for me. And yeah, I was pretty surprised at how the quality of the information that I got from them, especially, I'm not sure if it's still free, but at the time it was a free service.
That's awesome. And for the record, everybody listening, Justin didn't know that I was going to talk about Art of the Trek or that I had any plan to it. And I didn't even know that you had used their route planning service. But I mean, it is a tool for people to use that. I mean, currently it is still a free service. So you can go to artofthetrek.com and you can submit a route guide plan, where you basically fill out a questionnaire, just to give more detail of what Justin was talking about, but you fill out a questionnaire and that says, this is the kind of trip that I want to go on. This is where I would like to go. And a bunch of other information of how many days and are your dates flexible, yada, yada. And then they have experienced backpackers that put together full trip itineraries that have route information, GPX, or like GPS information that you can export as a GPX file and then put on your phone with various other mapping softwares. And then, the one that I did for Canyonlands, for a trip in Canyonlands, there was like specific permit information, and they will even help like obtain permits if necessary. Mm-hmm. Like the amount of information that's available for a new backpacker in that particular tool is phenomenal. Like, so yeah. We can't go this whole trip planning conversation without talking about a free tool that people have access to get really cool information. That's awesome that like you've actually used it and had a good experience with it.
Yeah, it was like I think for you and I, our kind of first inclination is to plan our own trips. I think we both enjoy that aspect of backpacking and getting outdoors. But yeah, it just worked out that at that point in time, I was just too busy. And I imagine for a lot of people out there, that is the case, at least at some point in the year. And having a tool like that was, it did blow my mind, the level of detail that they provided. And I can't express how cool that was. But I think it's important to note too, though, with that service, that it's still good to do your own due diligence on it. Yes. Too. It's,
yes, I think I'm glad you said that.
When I got all the information, I was like, okay, this is awesome, but it's still, I don't want to put my life in their hands entirely. So I went and took the kind of work that they did and just double checked it a little bit, made sure I understood what different things meant, and loaded up the GPS information into a map and took a look at that, just so that I understood what was happening. They narrowed it down and provided the distilled information, but it's still, you still need to make sure that you understand the planning part of it.
Yeah, that's really, really good information. I'm glad that you brought that up. And it kind of leads into the next two things that I want to talk about. And for everybody listening to this episode, like, I understand that what we're covering today is pretty global. In fact, Justin and I discussed before we started recording today that like we could spend an hour on every single one of these little things. Like, how do you find water? You could spend several hours and several podcast episodes talking about like just that one thing, or how to properly obtain permits for different areas. So we understand that maybe the conversation is a little jumbled and maybe a little disorganized, but you get the idea. However, what I'm getting at is I want to talk about risk management planning, since that is not something that I think a lot of people consider, and how important it is, more than just taking a first aid kit with you, and also leave no trace. So I want to start with leave no trace, because you bring up a good point about like, okay, somebody else did all this homework for you, but are you educated on your personal impact that you create when you are going out into this area? And this area could be anywhere. It could be the Appalachian Trail. It could be the Sierra. It could be the Northern Rockies. It could be all the way down in like Mexico, or I don't know. It doesn't matter where it is, but you create an impact. And is your education of that impact something that you are taking into consideration when you are planning a trip?
Yeah, I think leave no trace is something that is one of the most important topics. And I know you're a big advocate and talk about it quite a bit, as far, especially with the sensitivity that you encounter in the desert areas. That's something that I've seen on your YouTube channel quite a bit. From my experience as well, I think I see that a lot come winter time. Where I live, we have winter for nine months of the year, basically. So
it's a long time, brother.
It's long. And as soon as you get into like frozen ground scenarios where you have frozen ground, you're starting to have to deal with waste in a completely different way than digging cat holes in the summertime. And I know I'm pretty sure is this mostly a desert area where you have to carry, like, use wag bags and carry your waste out with you after, and by waste I mean poop.
Yeah, pretty much any of the desert areas. I mean, it's not like every single desert area here in Utah, but I think it's just good practice, because the bacteria and just the microorganisms that are in the sand ecosystems are not as prevalent. So the ability for human waste to break down and be broken down in those environments is not as like prevalent. So it's just good practice for somebody to, especially in the narrow canyons, for you to carry out your waste.
And I'm curious, from my, like, as someone who's never camped in the desert before, like up here, it's usually pretty obvious when you get a permit, like when you get a backcountry permit, or if you go to a specific area, they say like no fires, or make sure to pack your garbage out. Is it pretty common place? Like, is it readily available to have that information for some of these desert areas? I'm especially curious about places where you could potentially random camp without permits, if that even exists.
And you're not just speaking of like carrying out human waste specifically, right?
Human waste or any kind, like I imagine, like for most people, they're probably, I haven't really been to that many campsites where there's like garbage waste, but yeah, human waste for the most part that you're carrying out. I think that's always the one I'm most curious about. It's always an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, any of the popular trails are going to have signage information that will tell you the rules and the regulations for that area. And not every, like, there aren't necessarily backcountry rangers that are out patrolling to because there is so much public land here in Utah specifically, to basically police people to make sure that they're doing this correctly. But signage, when you get your permit at the trailhead, is going to have information on that. Any responsible person that is posting about the trip, like Coyote Gulch, for example, is a really popular trail here in Utah that, like, it is common knowledge and information everywhere over the internet that if you're going to hike Coyote Gulch, you carry wag bags. But the greater Escalante drainage, the Escalante River area within the Grand Staircase National Monument, there are, I mean, hundreds of miles of canyons that you can hike, and it's within a certain distance of the river itself that you're required to have a wag bag. But again, like, once you obtain a certain level of education and understanding of those particular ecosystems, you're better off to just always have a wag bag on your trip.
Well, that's what I was just thinking of. It's
I'm giving you a really long-winded answer to that, but like, the information is there, and I think it's easy for people to, if it's their very first time out and there is not anybody else that they have talked to and nobody else in their group has any understanding, they're like, okay, you get a mulligan. Next time, like, you know better.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's good to, I think you mentioned it, kind of err on the side of caution. If you're unsure, bring it with you. And I think the fact that if there's information at the trailheads, and I think it's the same up here, there's usually a lot of information in signage at the trailheads that I think probably 90% of people ignore, thinking it's the same thing every time, but there is trail specific information there. So it's good to read that. And it's kind of like, if you're unsure if it's going to be an icy trail, to bring micro spikes just in case. You may not need them, you can leave them in the car, but if you get to a trailhead and it's like, oh, you need a wag bag or something, then it's at least good to have it with you just in case.
Yeah, and that goes back to the conversations that you and the questions you would be asking when you are calling a ranger. That's often a conversation that I have, is like, hey, what are the requirements for human waste for that area? And they'll tell you straight up, like, oh yeah, you're fine to not use a wag bag, just dig a cat hole, carry out your toilet paper, that kind of thing. Just standard leave no trace type of practice. But they may also say, like, no, you've got to have wag bags, and we have them here available at the ranger station when you pick up your permit.
Okay.
I've been told that many different times. And like, even when it comes to water availability and that kind of stuff, like, that's a really important reason to ask those kinds of questions, because particularly here in Utah and a lot of the high use areas, like the John Muir Trail, for example, if you bring that into the equation, like, you've got all these people in very sensitive areas, sensitive water sources. And if you are potentially contaminating with your human waste these water sources, then you're creating a problem for animals, primarily, who that is their home, but also other visitors that are using the area in the future.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about leave no trace from a planning perspective, because I think a lot of people educate themselves on leave no trace and try to understand the seven principles, but I think it rarely comes up as of like something that you have to really prepare for. I find on trips you don't really see it talked about very much, so I'm glad we are talking about it, because I think it's super important, and there's a lot of things that you do need to take into account with it for preparedness, like campfires. I know there's some areas up here where there's no campfires allowed, and if you're kind of relying on campfire for some part of your trip, whether it's to dry things out, if you're doing a creek crossing right at the end of your day, or trying to stay warm or something, it's you definitely need to know if you're not allowed to have campfires.
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredibly important thing to me personally. And when I'm teaching, I'm going to share these types of questions that I ask my students. But then when they are putting together an assignment that's around trip planning, I have them study the seven principles of Lean No Trace. And anybody that is not familiar with the seven principles, like I highly encourage you and passively urge you to get educated. But I ask them to read through the seven principles, understand them, and then ask the following questions. And I've got just several questions here, so just bear with me. But after they've read through them, does your planned route have restrictions or specific area rules? If you don't know, how might you find out that information? Do your planned campsites follow Leave No Trace principles? Meaning, did you plan campsites that are more than 200 feet away from a water source and from the trail and those kinds of things? Mm-hmm. How will you dispose of waste? Are wag bags required for the area? Do you plan to have a campfire? If so, how will you have a responsible fire? Are fires allowed where you'll be traveling, or are there current fire restrictions? And that even goes with the types of stoves that you might be using. I know in California, for example, like alcohol stoves are pretty much not allowed anywhere. At least from what I've been told, I've actually never backpacked in California. So I could have misspoke a little bit there, but then things like, are you planning to bring an animal with you? Can the animal come with you? Like national parks don't allow animals in the backcountry. Mm-hmm. And how might bringing an animal with you, even if it is allowed, affect your trip and wildlife in the area? How will you respect other visitors? And how do these principles help sustain minimal recreational impact in the backcountry? Those are the kinds of questions that I like to ask.
Yeah, those are great questions. I think those should be incorporated in everyone's trip planning all the time. I think it's it was interesting hearing them, especially from a teaching perspective. You're asking these questions of, I think you mentioned that some people have been on in your classes have never backpacked before, have minimal experience. So it's good to get people thinking about them, and the way you phrase the questions, I think, make it easy to understand what the end goal is with asking the questions. So it's,
yeah, totally. Well, I appreciate that. So moving on to risk management, since this is something that's very important to me, particularly as I've become more educated in my like first aid training as a wilderness first responder, like risk management is something that I just am always thinking about. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious what kind of risk management plans you create for your personal trips, and like how detailed do you get, and maybe give like a little bit of definition of exactly what risk management is.
Yeah, for me, risk management is what might be coming down the pipe at me from a risk perspective on a trip, whether that's weather, wildlife, sketchy river crossings or avalanche terrain, and then mitigating those risks through actions or gear or whatever is kind of necessary in order to do that. And I look at risk, and I think this is pretty standard across the board, as the likelihood of something happening and then the consequences of that happening. So you can have scenarios where you have a very low likelihood of it happening, but might have a very high consequence, like death. And then that that consequence or that likelihood influences how you manage that risk. And I guess I can run through an example for me a lot of the time, and I get asked this all the time. I think it's probably one of the biggest backcountry fears out there, and that's wildlife, specifically bears. I imagine you probably get this all the time too, is people being quite afraid of bears from a risk perspective.
Yeah, it's not as prevalent for me here where I live. We have bears, but like I have never seen a bear in Utah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, it's a weird thing. I probably get asked every week from people how to deal with bears, but it's one of those things where the likelihood from a risk perspective is extremely, extremely low. So the consequences are fairly high if it's a bad encounter, but the likelihood's low. So when I'm thinking about how do I manage this risk, I'm usually using, I use bear spray. I bring bear spray with me, and then I'm loud. I do things that I can control in order to let the bears know that I'm coming. And that's how I manage the risk from an active standpoint. And then I look at how I can manage the risk in case of worst case scenario. Like if I get mauled by a bear, how am I going to stay safe as long as the bear didn't kill me? And, and that's where I start taking into account emergency response scenarios. So I use, a satellite communicator device, and I have check-ins with people back home. So I check in the morning when I'm leaving camp. And then depending on the trip, I'll definitely check in once I get to camp. But I've been on trips, solo trips, where I've been going through bear country and like very sketchy bear heavy areas. So in that scenario, the likelihood of an encounter has increased, which has increased the risk. And that's, I started checking in every hour with my inReach. And that way, whoever the people I was checking in, if they didn't hear from me, then they knew within several miles where I was likely going to be. And rescuers would hopefully be able to get to me in time if I was mauled and bleeding out in order to save my life, hopefully. So those are kind of the two different things I look at, from an active risk management and then a worst case, like if we're into emergency response scenario, how that looks and how I'm managing each of those based on likelihood and then consequence.
Oh, that's really interesting perspective to hear that, particularly on the wildlife side of things. And I think that, I mean, even the satellite communicator aspect is another important tool for somebody to consider in your planning. Just digging into that a little bit, make sure A, that you know how to use it, and that when you are creating a risk management plan, this is a little bit more detailed, but like you tell loved ones, your spouse, your best friend, your mom, your dad, whoever it is, that is your like primary contact, that, hey, this is when I'm going, this is where I'm going to be, and I will check in at these times on my satellite device. And I think it's important too that you have clear communication on what potentially not hearing from me means, whether yes. that is a reason to freak out. But I also give my wife information of, this is when I plan to be home, and this, if you don't hear from me by such and such time of day on this date, then that is reason to be concerned. Yeah. If you don't hear from me by this time on this date, then that is freak out time. Basically.
Exactly. I think that's a good point as far as laying out the expectations and the results. If like you said, if you're supposed to check in at this time and you don't, do they send you, if you have a two-way communication device, they can send you a message and say, hey, did you just forget, or are you in trouble? And then I think what I usually do is I ask them to do that. And then if they don't hear from you within a certain amount of time, then implement the emergency plan. When usually I type up an email and then email it off to my contact with the phone number, email address of the local emergency services.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Well, and then not to take too much more time on this, but when it comes to just general risk management planning, like other questions that you have to ask yourself are just, and it may not, you may not think of it as like, oh yeah, I'm making a risk management plan by asking these questions. But you, when you are asking yourself, what kind of environmental things am I going to experience? I looked at the weather report. Okay. It's going to be rainy. Like, how am I making gear decisions differently based off of that weather report? I mean, that's essentially part of a risk management plan. Your gear that you're planning is helping you mitigate potential risks. If I decide, oh yeah, I'm going to wear jeans and a t-shirt for this day hike and I get super wet, like, we know that cotton is going to be basically a
it's going to kill you. Cotton kills.
A conducive environment for hypothermia and just all sorts of bad things. I don't necessarily agree 100% that cotton kills, but we don't need to talk about that.
I like cotton in some scenarios. I'll agree with you on that one.
Yeah. But my point is that, like, your decisions that you make for your gear need to match the conditions that you're going to be experiencing. That's part of a risk management plan. You're mitigating potential hazards that you would experience out there based off where you're taking. You might choose a different shelter because you're going to experience particular weather patterns that taking a tarp doesn't make sense, but taking a heavier shelter, full freestanding tent is what I mean. Like, those are the kinds of decisions as well that truly are part of a risk management plan.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like, cause I've heard you talk about that as far as, especially with tents. I think, you're in a unique area where you're in different environments that, especially from a tent perspective, different tents perform better and some might not even perform at all in some of the environments that you go camping and backpacking in, which is, I don't think, something a lot of, like, people, think about in some other places. And with at least with the variety that you in of areas that you go into. I think you just released a video about four different tents on your YouTube channel that you use.
Yes, I did. And particular reasons. And it's kind of interesting to see, not to get on a YouTube tangent, but I had a few people that were like, this is overkill. You don't need that many shelters. Why would you have four different things when one of those, a singular tent, would accomplish the needs for what all of those would be doing? And I mean, it's accurate, but, like, there is the point of the gear needs to match the environment.
Yeah.
Setting up a non-freestanding tent in the snow is very difficult, or on the ice is going to be very difficult if we're using, like, your environment, for example, or in the deep sand in southern Utah. It's going to be difficult to get a stake to hold that's going to hold up enough tension for a non-freestanding tent in a windstorm to be able to, like, survive and hold itself up during that. So a freestanding tent is going to make more sense for that application. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting to understand. I think you can get away with a narrower set of gear if you're not pushing that gear to its limit. So I think it's important to understand the limits of your gear and then plan for the conditions that you're going out in. I tell people, when people ask me if they can use a three-season tent in wintertime, I say, sure, depends on the kind of trip you're planning. And if you're going out and it's not going to be, you're not going to have 2 feet of snow falling and you're not on the side of a mountain, you can probably get away with a three-season tent in wintertime. But it's, you have to plan your trip and then take into account what your gear limitations might be if you don't have access to something that might be able to handle the conditions that you're going out, that you want to go out in.
Yeah, totally. And for the sake of time, we didn't get to discuss a lot of the gear aspects, but I think just some of those like general questions to ask yourself. And basically probably the most important is, does my gear support the season or the conditions that I will experience?
Mm-hmm.
And be very willing mentally to say, no, it's not going to, I should postpone my trip. Or, yeah, I have what I need. I have the right layering system for crazy winter windstorms and heavy snow. I have the right shelter system. I have the right, all of the things that are going to protect me in that particular environment. Or on the flip side, in a high alpine summer trip where things are less likely to go wrong, you can be a little bit more forgiving with your gear.
Yep.
But you still have to ask that question. Like, does the gear that I have, and it doesn't matter what the gear is. It doesn't matter if it's a 10-pound tent. Like, that is not what I'm saying in this, but does the gear support the season and the conditions that you're going to be experiencing? And yeah, I say that all the time in my videos. Like, we'll be filming a video about gear, talking about it, and I have that thought pop into my head, but like, it's super important.
I think it's what it kind of, everything kind of comes full circle with that statement of making sure that what you're bringing matches the conditions that you're going to be going out in. And I think the gear and then your knowledge and experience, I think when all those things align, then you end up having a good trip and everyone has fun and comes home safely.
Yeah. And I mean, that basically you wrapped it up with that sentence there. Like, a successful trip is going to be executed because you put together a good like trip itinerary that had proper route information, and you did your homework and your research, and you have a good understanding of your impact with like your Leave No Trace implementation, risk management plan, and then your gear supports being able to execute that particular route and trip that you have planned. And that's, I mean, at the end of the day or the end of the trip, that's how you end up with a successful trip. So yeah, Justin, awesome information, like stoked at all of the things that we just talked about for the last hour. It was a lot of fun.
That was a lot of fun. I learned a bunch too, which is always fun. And I think something that I'm always looking to do too. So thanks for the conversation. It's interesting chatting with, I don't think I've had this conversation with someone before. And I really enjoyed having it with you because you bring that neat dynamic of having tons and tons of experience, but also with your teaching, interacting with people with little experience. So it's really great seeing that gap bridged.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. And just enjoy your perspective as well, particularly being in a different country. That's very exciting because I think you're actually the first international guest that I've had.
Yeah.
So super cool. But I think at some point we're going to have to get on and have another conversation that can be a little bit more pinpoint focus on things. But I think this really did give like a good global understanding of all of the things to consider. I know it was a little scattered here and there, but I mean, that's part of the fun of having these kinds of conversations.
Exactly.
Why don't you go ahead and, since I didn't spend much time at the beginning, introduce or like plug your YouTube channel, how people can find you and see all of the great content you're putting out there that's very educational, very helpful for people. So yeah, plug yourself and all that.
Definitely. Yeah. So my YouTube channel is kind of the primary place where I put information out. And the channel name is Justin Outdoors. It's my goal with the channel is to help people get comfortable in the backcountry, where that's finding the best pillow or sleeping pad for a good sleep, or lightening your pack so hiking is easier and less painful at the end of the day, or providing knowledge so that you're less scared of bears, or you understand the risks of going out more so you feel more comfortable when you're out on a trip. Like we just talked about, this is the kind of information that I like to share on my channel as well. And yeah, check it out. I do a lot of backpacking canoe trips in the summertime, and then a bunch of winter backpacking trips during the winter. And if you're interested in gear, I probably have done a review of a piece of gear that you're looking to check out. So yeah, check out Justin Outdoors.
Oh, that's awesome. And everybody should go watch a particular video that Justin has where he loaded everything up onto an electric bike, broke down the bike, loaded it into a kayak, right?
Inflatable canoe.
And then paddled, set up camp, all the modes of travel that you could imagine. It was a really, really well done trip. So Justin, super appreciate it, man. And we're going to have to do this again, but yeah, really, definitely. Really grateful for your time.
Thanks. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We'll definitely have to get on a trip once everything's opened up as well.
That'd be great. Be sure to check out Justin's YouTube channel, where he's been sharing a lot of awesome winter camping and backpacking information that's really, really well put together. Thank you for listening today, and invite you to check out my other episodes if you haven't already. I hope everyone has an awesome day today, and I will catch you next time on the next episode of the Backpacking Experience.